You're home here at the O'Day Pod. We simply sit with God's amazing word, unpack it in everyday language, discover what it looks like to walk it out every day, and then surround it with amazing music. Like a warm hug from heaven, wherever this finds you, rushing to work, prepping dinner, or finally chilling out. My hope is that God's word meets you in that exact moment, just as you are. And now let's head into today's deep dive.
Welcome to the deep dive. Picture this for a second. You're standing in this small village, Bethany. You're, you know, just about 3 kilometers east of Jerusalem.
Right.
You're standing on the eastern slopes of the Mount of Olives. The air is just heavy with the scent of burial spices, the dust of the Judean hillside, and the sound of this ancient communal mourning. And then the impossible happens.
Yeah.
A man who's been dead for 4 days.
4 days.
Right, 4 days, still bound head to toe in his linen grave clothes, just walks out of a tomb.
It is an incredibly dramatic scene to visualize. Just the sheer shock of witnessing life emerge from a place of absolute biological finality. I mean, you can almost feel the collective intake of breath from the crowd.
Oh, completely. And that breathtaking moment, that is the foundation of today's deep dive. We are exploring a really fascinating stack of material today. It encompasses historical analysis, some linguistic breakdowns of the original Greek text, and some incredibly poignant lyrical adaptations.
Yeah, the lyrical stuff is great.
It is. And it's all based on the biblical narrative of John chapter 11, specifically verses 45 through 53. Our mission today is to uncover how a single, undeniable act of life simultaneously awakened belief and ignited a really deadly political conspiracy.
Because it's a text that operates on so many interconnected levels at once. You have the immediate historical reality on the ground, the precarious geopolitical tension with the Roman Empire, and of course, the deeply spiritual undercurrents that drive the entire narrative forward.
Right. Now, before we jump into the mechanics of this narrative, I want to be completely transparent with you, the listener. The material we are exploring today contains deeply theological and religiously significant perspectives.
Yes.
And we want to be crystal clear from the jump that we are not taking sides here or endorsing any specific viewpoints. Our goal is just to impartially explore the profound concepts, the historical context, and the artistic lyrical adaptations contained within this material. We're examining this as a uniquely fascinating piece of history and literature.
Absolutely. We are here to synthesize the information, you know, to understand the cultural and political machinery at work in the first century, and to look at the psychological realities of the people involved, regardless of where anyone stands personally.
Right. So let's start right at the catalyst. We have this jaw-dropping resurrection of Lazarus. The historical accounts indicate that the crowd of Judean mourners who witnessed this had wildly different immediate reactions. Could you explain the mechanics of that moment and how this community fractured so violently?
Yeah, the immediate split in the crowd's reaction is, frankly, one of the most fascinating psychological studies in ancient literature. You have a group of people who had traveled the short distance from Jerusalem to console Mary and Martha.
Right. They're just there to mourn.
Exactly. They are standing right there. They hear Jesus call a dead man back to life. They see Lazarus walk out of the dark, and they respond with genuine faith. They witnessed the miracle and believed, but then Right next to them,
breathing the exact same air.
Breathing the exact same air, witnessing the exact same impossible event. You have another faction. Instead of being broken down in awe, their hearts harden. They immediately turn their backs on the empty tomb, leave the scene of the resurrection, and rush back to Jerusalem to alert the religious authorities.
I find that division just staggering. I mean, if you see a dead man literally walk out of a grave, how is your first instinct political self-preservation rather than absolute awe?
It's wild.
Let's break down that first group, though. What specific type of belief are we talking about here? Because seeing a guy walk out of a tomb isn't really something you can intellectually deny.
That is a crucial distinction. If we look at the original Greek text, the word used for believed in this specific passage is pistou.
Pistou.
Yes. And this is vastly different from mere intellectual assent. It isn't just a crowd nodding their heads and saying, yes, we acknowledge the empirical evidence that this man was dead and is now alive.
Right, checking a box.
Right. Pistou carries the rich, comprehensive meaning of wholehearted trust and personal commitment. It means entrusting your entire self to the person who performed the act. For this faction of the crowd, the miracle wasn't a magic trick to be analyzed. It was a sign pointing directly to the identity of Jesus, prompting a life-altering surrender of their worldview.
So pistis is this deep, all-encompassing trust. But then you have the informants, the people who saw the exact same biological impossibility and literally ran the other way to inform the Pharisees. What is the cultural or psychological driver behind that reaction?
To understand the informants, we really have to grasp the incredibly fragile political and religious ecosystem of first century Judea. Reports like this to the religious leaders were actually standard protocol when anything threatened the established order.
So they weren't necessarily the bad guys in their own minds.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. These individuals weren't necessarily walking around twisting their mustaches trying to be villains. They were operating within an entrenched system where any disruption, even a miraculous, life-giving one, was viewed as a dangerous anomaly. The authorities needed to maintain strict control to keep the peace.
Wow.
So instead of celebrating a restored life, these informants became instruments in a growing systemic opposition. One of the lyrical adaptations we reviewed captures this dissonance perfectly. It describes the mourners' wails transforming into the frantic, whispered footsteps of the informants rushing back to the city.
You know, for you listening right now, if you ever find yourself struggling to see divine truth clearly, or if you wonder why highly intelligent people can look at the exact same data and come to completely opposite conclusions, look at the profound reality presented right here. The exact same undeniable event, a resurrected man, can either draw a heart toward grace and prompt that pistou, or it can trigger an immediate defensive mechanism. It causes people to oppose what they cannot control or what threatens their established paradigm.
It highlights a universal human tendency. The light that draws one person in to investigate is the exact same light that makes another person shield their eyes and retreat to the familiarity of the shadows.
It is wild to think about the geography of this moment, too.
Yeah.
You have this incredible scene of life and revelation unfolding in Bethany, and just 3 kilometers down the road in Jerusalem, that exact same event triggers a room full of absolute panic.
Absolute chaos.
Let's look at that emergency gathering of the Sanhedrin.
So the Sanhedrin, of course, was the supreme ruling council of 71 leaders. It was comprised of the chief priests and the Pharisees. Now, these were two groups that fundamentally disagreed on almost everything. Theology, politics, resurrection.
They didn't even like each other.
No, not at all. Yet this event forces them to call an urgent, unified emergency session to confront what they view as an existential crisis.
But what exactly was the root of their panic? Because from a modern outside perspective, a robe teacher healing people and raising the dead doesn't immediately sound like a national security threat.
It all comes down to their desperate question, which is actually recorded in the text. They ask, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs."
Wait, so they admit he's doing miracles?
Yes. What is incredible here is the total absence of denial. They aren't trying to debunk the resurrection. They acknowledge the undeniable reality of these miracles. I love how some of our historical commentary frames these signs. They're essentially heavenly billboards of divine authority.
Heavenly billboards. I love that.
Right. But the council, steeped in their political reality, chooses to view these heavenly billboards as terrifying threats to their national stability rather than a message of salvation.
So what was the specific geopolitical anxiety keeping these 71 elite leaders awake at night?
Rome. The absolute overarching terror in the room was Roman retaliation. The council states their fear explicitly. They say, if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.
Take away our place.
That phrase, our place, is vital to understand. It refers to the sacred temple complex and their specific, highly privileged positions of power. The Pax Romana, the Roman peace, was notoriously brutal. Rome allowed the Jewish leaders to keep their religious authority, but only under a microscopic, heavily armed watch.
So any slip-up?
Any slip-up. If a massive popular movement crowned Jesus as a king, the Roman Empire wouldn't bother investigating the theology. They would view it as an insurrection and bring the hammer down, crushing the holy site and stripping the Sanhedrin of their elite status.
The historical irony of that calculation is just staggering when you look at the timeline.
It is one of the great tragic ironies of antiquity. These leaders were completely blinded by their political anxiety. They actively rejected the promised Messiah specifically to protect their nation and their temple from the wrath of the Roman legions.
Right.
But by choosing that path, they set into motion the exact catastrophe they were trying to avoid. In AD 70, roughly 4 decades after this emergency meeting, the Romans did exactly what the council feared. Following a Jewish revolt, the legions under Titus marched in, besieged Jerusalem, and burned the temple to the ground.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The very nation and place they sought to protect by sacrificing Jesus was entirely annihilated because of the political machinery they activated in this room.
So by ruthlessly trying to save their place, they guaranteed its absolute destruction. Inside this panicked council meeting, the dialogue is framed as a clash of two very distinct arguments. Can you break down the dynamic of that room?
Yeah. So on one side, you have the wider council of the Pharisees. They are hand-wringing. They are confused. They are panicked. They are asking the open-ended question, what are we to do? They are paralyzed by the implications of these undeniable signs. On the other side, cutting through all that panic noise, you have the cold, blunt, ruthless political logic of one man who silences the room.
Enter Caiaphas. The historical record highlights that he was the Roman-appointed high priest that year. What is his stance in this clash?
Caiaphas steps forward with a breathtaking level of arrogance. He looks at the supreme ruling council of his nation, the greatest theological minds of Judea, and says, "You know nothing at all."
Just shuts them down entirely.
Completely dismisses their anxiety. And then he delivers this chilling, purely pragmatic calculation. He says, "Nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish."
Caiaphas frames this entirely around cynical political pragmatism. He's essentially suggesting a state-sponsored murder to balance the ledger with Rome. But he unwittingly introduces the concept of substitutionary death here, which is central to the theology of the text.
Exactly. And the Greek preposition hyper does the heavy linguistic lifting in that sentence.
Hyper.
Yeah. Caiaphas says one man should die hypo the people, which translates to for or in place of the people. This is the bedrock of substitutionary atonement.
The innocent dying for the guilty. The righteous stepping in for the unrighteous, so that the people wouldn't have to face the wrath of the ruling power.
Precisely. Caiaphas meant it with entirely selfish, murderous intent. Execute one popular teacher so the rest of us don't lose our wealth, our temple, and our lives to the Romans. But the words he used flawlessly describe the exact spiritual mechanic of what Jesus was about to accomplish on the cross.
But Caiaphas wasn't secretly a believer harboring a deep theological insight. How does a cynical political murder plot transform into a sacred prophecy within the text?
This raises a fascinating question about how prophecy and divine inspiration operate in this historical context. The author of the text makes it exceptionally clear that Caiaphas was not speaking from his own inherent wisdom or righteousness. The Greek text utilizes the word prophetu.
Prophetu, which implies what exactly in this moment?
Prophetuge means to declare truth under divine inspiration. The text explains that specifically because Caiaphas was the high priest that fateful year, God sovereignly used the office even if the man holding it was corrupt. The Holy Spirit moved through his vocal cords so that he declared an absolute divine truth, even though he himself did not understand or believe a single word of its true meaning.
That's incredible.
He was an entirely unwitting mouthpiece. The lyrical adaptations we're analyzing capture this dynamic beautifully.
Yeah, there is one lyrical piece in our stack that describes Caiaphas as a prophet unwilling, yet truth rang clear. I love that phrasing. It perfectly encapsulates the irony. A prophet unwilling. The melody underneath those lyrics is very dark, very brooding, which fits the mood of a conspiracy perfectly, but the words declare a triumph.
It is a stunning literary and theological example of sovereignty. Using the primary enemy of the gospel to preach its most central foundational message, the very man plotting the murder is the one who officially announces the concept of substitutionary atonement to the world.
Following the narrative arc of the text, this intervention by Caiaphas changes the trajectory of history. Up until verse 53, this was a heated debate. But that specific verse marks a definitive, incredibly dark turn.
It absolutely does. John 11.53 states, "So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death." That is the permanent pivot point of the narrative. The highest council of the land shifts from a panicked, theoretical debate to a deliberate, sealed conspiracy. The official plot to kill the one they call the author of life begins right there.
Oh.
The miracle of resurrection that should have led them to their knees in worship instead firmly sealed their murderous resolve.
Let's expand on the actual scope of this planned death, because Caiaphas explicitly said it was for the nation. He was thinking hyper-locally. He wanted to preserve Judea. But the text immediately expands on that scope heavily. Who was this substitutionary death actually for?
The scope is massively expanded beyond anything Caiaphas could have comprehended. The author adds his own commentary immediately after the prophecy, clarifying that this death wasn't for the nation of Israel only. And here we encounter another brilliant Greek verb, synagogue.
synago.
Which means to gather into one.
To gather into one.
Yes. The text reveals that the ultimate purpose of this substitutionary death was to actively assemble all the scattered children of God from every corner of the earth into one single unified flock. This means Jew and Gentile alike.
So it's a global scale.
Entirely global. The death that Caiaphas plotted to save his own local political skin was, in reality, the exact mechanism that would be used to tear down every ethnic and religious dividing wall, creating a global family.
We see that global expansive tension echoed so powerfully in the lyrical adaptations, too. They have these repeating vocal lines that weave the whole scene together. The lyrics say, "Earthly counting in their spite." One dies for the nation, one dies for the scattered sheep. It really highlights the stark contrast between what the men in that room were mathematically counting on and what was actually being accomplished on a cosmic scale.
That phrase, earthly counting, is brilliant. You can picture the Sanhedrin sitting there, counting their political chips, trying to balance the ledger with Rome to maintain their grip on power, completely unaware they were triggering the salvation and the gathering of the scattered sheep across the entire globe.
Which brings us to a really compelling way to summarize this entire deep dive. When you synthesize all the history, the Greek linguistics, and the lyrical art we've covered today, the entire narrative is built on these stark, profound contrasts.
That is the best way to view it. If we lay it all out, we see these clear, contrasting pairs defining the human experience in this story. You have the desperate, clinging political fear of the religious leaders standing in direct opposition to the sovereign divine plan.
Yes.
You have this cold earthly calculation, executing an innocent man just to protect a temporal throne in a stone building, contrasted with heaven's eternal decree. Ultimately, you are watching the sheer wrath of men collide with the grace of a willing sacrifice.
It leaves us with a fascinating psychological question to mull over. When we look at this ancient text, it forces us to hold up a mirror. When you are confronted with a paradigm-shifting reality, something that completely challenges your worldview, your comfort, or your place in society, how do you react? Do you react like the Sanhedrin, doubling down on defensive walls and cold calculation, willing to suppress the truth to maintain control? Or are you willing to respond with pist? Are you willing to embrace that wholehearted trust, stepping into the light of something much bigger, even if it costs you your established paradigm?
That is the enduring historical challenge of this text. It isn't just an ancient story. It's a constant question of how we handle disruptive truth.
And as you think about how you process disruptive truth, I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to explore on your own. It builds on an incredible image found in the lyrical adaptations we studied, which speak of Elohim's sovereign turning wrath to praise. Consider how often in human history, the very schemes, conspiracies, and betrayals designed to crush a movement are the exact tools used to guarantee its ultimate victory. Think about Caiaphas. He was the ultimate political pragmatist, desperate to preserve his legacy and his place. In 1990, archaeologists actually discovered his family tomb. They found his ossuary, his bone box, beautifully carved but containing nothing more than dust and bones. The man who orchestrated a death to secure his own legacy is remembered only as a footnote, an unwitting prophet whose own bones sit in a museum, while the tomb of the man he condemned remains the most famously empty real estate in human history.
A truly powerful juxtaposition.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you for being part of the O'Day Pod family today. I pray that God's word and our discussion have left you feeling truly enlightened. We'd love to see you again next episode. Until then, here's the featured song from today's show.
Lazarus walked from the tomb that day. Many believed as the light broke through. Yet some ran swift to the Pharisees' hall, whispering fear of what Rome might do. Council convened in the shadowed room. Signs undeniable, power confessed, but hearts grew hard. Blind to the Lamb standing in there.
True lamb is slain, each head he gathers is scattered to be.